At this time of Samhain, when the veils between the worlds are thin, through the power of one mind, with the pure love of one heart, we open a portal to the other side. We peel back the veil, and we call to those of our ancestors and beloved dead who would like to experience this time of magic with us. We invite them to be fully present in this sacred space, to see through our eyes, to move through our bodies, to speak through our words, and to dance in this space with us. Until we close our circle, when they will return across the Great Divide, we welcome the ancestors. Blessed be. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. That which is remembered never dies. 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 All things change. All things change. All things change. All things change.
That which is remembered never dies. That which is remembered.
The portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Pass through the portal, go through the gate, enter and be reborn. Enter and be reborn. Enter and be reborn.
Well, good evening.
At this time of Samhain,
There we go. Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. Well, with Samhain around the corner, when the veil of the worlds are thinnest and we believe we might be able to connect with our ancestors, I thought it was appropriate to not just play a little snippet of that cut, but to honor this time of year and play the entire cut from one of my favorite artists, Abigail Spinner McBride. She hails from Las Vegas, and that was called Pass Through the Portal. Hope you enjoyed it. Well, you know, I have to admit, I have been so forgetful lately. I realized this as I was looking at some of my past show scripts. I have been forgetting to remind you about the three F's. Yes, click the follow button on my show page so you don't miss news of my wonderful guests that come on the show and share their insight with you each week. The second F is to become a friend of the growing family of Voices of the Sacred Feminine listeners across the states and across the globe. And now our third F, it's for Facebook. I hope you'll go to my pages on Facebook. There's now a Voices of the Sacred Feminine radio page, and they're pages for my two books, Walking Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. It's just called Walking Ancient Path, though, and Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations. If you go there and tell me you heard what I'm about to say on my show, that I'm giving away books to the first three listeners I hear from, you might just be a winner of my award-winning book, Walking an Ancient Path. As I said, the subtitle is Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Speaking of which, with the holidays around the corner, I hope you'll consider one of my books for your friends and loved ones. Walking an Ancient Path was a finalist in the USA National Best Books Awards. It discusses how one can work with the divine feminine energy and help one get ideas about traveling to sacred sites, doing ritual, being inspired by goddess. I actually come clean and say some pretty revealing things, sharing some personal and magical stories that happened when I believe Goddess really listened and interceded in my life, changing the path I was on, actually. I have just a little snippet I'm going to share with you now from Chapter 17. It goes like this. I was facing a medical procedure, mundane perhaps to some, but nevertheless for me, I was worried. I was trying not to think about the procedure in the days before my appointment, but in the car going to the medical doctor, I did not have that luxury of denial anymore. I find myself calling out to Isis, asking her to please help me and let this procedure be painless. I asked her to guide the doctor's hand and to allow the experience to be without any complications. The prayers, I realized, were taking the form of mantras, and I kept them running in my mind and in my heart. As I was led to the table, an assistant told me it would be a few more minutes and asked if I wanted to read a magazine. Interestingly, she directed my attention to a stack, and my eyes instantly caught sight of the issue of National Geographic with a cover story about the Valley of the Kings. As I opened the magazine to the Egypt article, I saw a picture of Isis and all her colorful splendor on a wall inside a tomb. My left and right brain began their usual dance. Is this a coincidence, or is this too statistically unlikely to have happened to brush off as such? I intuitively felt this was definitely Isis speaking to me in a language I would listen to. After all, the physical confirmations were harder for me to deny than intuitions or feelings sometimes. I kept the magazine open on my lap during the procedure and my hand on the picture of Isis when I was not tensely gripping the armrests. When the doctor came in and gave me an injection, to my tremendous surprise, I didn't even feel the pain of the injection, which was actually cause for concern because I kept waiting for the pain to hit a nerve. Everything was happening so fast, but I just kept repeating the earlier mantra in my mind to block out the whirling sounds all around me. I have to admit, the battle of the left and the right brain continued in my head along with the mantra. Would I have been pain-free without Isis's help? Then I got a feeling, or perhaps you might call it a thought. It's hard to explain now which it was, but it was undeniable. Still very afraid and waiting for the pain to grab me any second, I continued to lay there tense and tightly gripping the armrests. Then I got the sense that Isis's body became the table on which I was laying. Her wings were the armrest now encircling me. Toth, god of science and medicine, was in the corner watching over the scene, and I had the thought come to me, or did I hear it? You have nothing to worry about. Nothing will happen to you. You have much work to do. I instantly had a sense of well-being and my tense grip on the armrest. My fear diminished almost completely, and the physical sensation that flowed through my body was hard to explain. It was a real effort to keep the tears from streaming down my eyes, but these were not tears of pain. In fact, my husband thought I had been in agony when I walked into the waiting room where he was waiting for me, and it was an hour or so before I could verbally share the experience with him. That's just a little snippet of one of several experiences that I hope you'll enjoy if you happen to pick up my book. And speaking of books, I have two coming out next year being published by John Hunt Publishers. First is titled Goddess Calling, Inspirational Messages and Meditations of Sacred Feminine Liberation Theology. And the second one is directly inspired by the show here. It's titled Voices of the Sacred Feminine, Conversations to Reshape the World, where I've handpicked about 30 of my past guests, and they've either contributed essays to the book or I'm printing our transcripts from the show. I'll be telling you more about that in the months ahead, maybe even share some of those excerpts. Well, with that all out of the way, I'd also love it if you would keep sending me feedback. Let me know what you like about the show, if there are any topics or guests you want me to interview. Tell me what the show has meant to you. And you keep me going, dear listeners. You are gas in my tank. And many of my guests and topics come straight from your recommendations. Speaking of which, I want to thank Pat for sending me some very interesting articles. Couple things I want to share with you that I think you'll find interesting. These come from Pat, who tipped me off to look at them on the Smithsonian Magazine, which is online. The first was an article about female killer whales go through menopause. Interesting. Female humans, pilot whales, and killer whales are unique among animals. They are the only three mammals known to undergo menopause. Killer whales were just added to the list. Rather than stay fertile until they die, these females lose their abilities to have babies well before the end of their lives. This allows them to help their children survive into adulthood and, if they're lucky, to act as grandmothers to the next generation. Female killer whales, researchers from the University of Exeter found, can have babies from sexual maturity until their 30s, but many live an additional 40 or 50 years as infertile caretakers for those around them. The researchers monitored around 500 killer whales for more than 30 years. This life history pattern likely evolved as a way for the female whales to ensure their genetic mark in the world does indeed get passed on. For menopause to evolve, the benefits of stopping reproduction in late life have to outweigh the costs, the researchers explained to Nat Geo. Evidence for this abounds in killer whales. In the year after their mother died, for example, male killer whales' chance of dying themselves was 14 times greater than that of whales whose mothers were still around to protect them. There may be other species whose female members go through menopause, the researchers told Nat Geo, but for now the only ones scientists are sure of are those special three. Whether female pilot whales and killer whales also experience typical human symptoms of menopause, such as hot flashes, is also an open-ended question, they say. Well, if I have time later, I will read you some snippets from the other article she sent me, and that's about how there's new evidence that grandmothers were crucial for human evolution. Another good one. So, anyway, let's go ahead and turn our attention to tonight's show. First up tonight, we have with us Kathy Pagano, hailing from Las Vegas. She's going to be discussing her book, Wisdom's Daughters, How Women Can Change the World, which includes discussions on Lady Wisdom and symbolic language that is so important to our imagination, transformation, and growth. You know what they say, if you're not constantly changing and transforming, you're getting stagnant, and we know Goddess changes everything she touches. Second up is Celeste Charnel, whose work today is about empowering women to step into their goddesshood. Celeste was another of the women in the documentary I've been talking about, Femme Women Healing the World. She's into holistic health care options for the body, mind, and spirit for people and animals. We'll talk about rewriting the subconscious programming we received from conception. Epigenetics, or nurture over nature, and ascension, the act of rising into our higher selves, activating our imaginal selves. I'll leave it to Celeste to explain all that. I think it will be great food for stimulating exchange. And while I open up the chat room for your questions, please listen to a brief word from Joe Carson in Dancing with Gaia, and then we'll get right to Kathy.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and the divine were all connected. They were together. But there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
That's the sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Blood of her veins, the rivers, voice of her breath, the wind, fire of her will, erupting volcanoes, green of her hair, the rolling grass hills, strength of her spine, mountains, tall backs, Persephone, moon maiden, whose returning steps grant springtime once more. These are the opening words from Dancing with Gaia. Dancing with Gaia is a wonderful film about the goddess, sacred sexuality, and about connecting to the earth and ways to do it. Gives you tools to connect in a very real way to the landscape and spirit of the earth around you. It's also visually stunning. The DVD comes packaged with a useful booklet, and it's only $20 from dancingwithgaia.com. And I want to thank Joe Carson for having me run these commercials. They do help me pay to keep Voices of the Sacred Feminine on the air because guests no longer get airtime free, and I am happy to pay for the airtime so that my wonderful guests can share their insight and teach listeners every week, month in and month out. Okay, so I'd like to welcome Kathy Pagano to the show. Hey, Kathy, you're still there with me, huh?
Hi, yes, I am. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Kathy, I'm going to start out by sharing your bio with listeners, and then we'll jump in and start talking about your book, okay?
Fine.
Kathy's a Jungian-trained psychotherapist, astrologer, mythic storyteller, and wisdom coach. She's the author of a new book, Wisdom's Daughters, How Women Can Change the World, a symbolic, mythic inquiry into the image of Lady Wisdom as cosmic conscious woman, a woman clothed with the sun, standing on the moon, and crowned with stars, the goddess energy that can change our world. With over 30 years of working with dreams, mythology, feminine spirituality, and symbolic language, Kathy leads wise women salons, helping women reclaim our feminine gifts of wisdom, love, and imagination. In her private practice, she guides people in the use of the imagination, helping them open up to their own wisdom and self-awareness. She uses astrology to help people understand the blueprint of their lives and dream work to understand how they're using their energies and dealing with unconscious complexes. The focus of her work is to help people, especially women, individuate, become their own original self. Kathy is an initiated priestess of Sekhmet through the Temple of Sekhmet, Nevada, called by this great goddess in her dreams. Kathy writes bimonthly astrological newsletters, The Cosmic Story, and contributes astrological blogs to astro.com. She also writes a monthly blog about emerging archetypal themes in movies, stories, and astrology at the Bard's Grove. Her four grown children will tell you she learned everything she knows from dealing with them. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for being with us tonight. It sounds like this is going to be really interesting. Was there anything in particular that inspired you to put pen to paper and write Wisdom's Daughters?
Well, the idea or the image or the energy of it came from a dream that I had at the Jung Institute when I was training there. And it was quite a while ago. And it was such a deep dream. And unfortunately, I always had big archetypal dreams, not unfortunately, but fortunately for me. But even the Jung Institute is a patriarchal institution in many ways. And often my therapist didn't quite know what to do with me. But then I learned astrology, and I understood why I constantly have archetypal dreams. And very much my all of my personal planets are in the house of the collective unconscious. So, of course, I would become a filter for that in many ways.
Okay.
So the dream I had was really beautiful, but it was so big, and I thought, how can I encompass this in my life? It began with a wounded lion. And as we were there, I was at a triple crossroads, so of course Hecate's special place, and I looked up and there was a waning moon, and then suddenly a big giant tidal wave came, and I thought, this is it. But suddenly the wave was passed, and it was a waxing moon, and a voice from, you know how in dreams they are, a voice from out of the blue said, you will be the mother of a savior, of the savior. You know, waking up to a dream like that, you begin to say, okay, in what way is this part of my life?
No pressure,
I do have four children. I thought, I cannot project this onto them. This would be devastating if I tried to put this onto them. And then I began to say, and this is, like, really big just for me, so what should I do? And as I studied different spiritual traditions, different mythological traditions, I found this beautiful image in a book that I don't particularly buy into, but it's so interesting because it's such a different image from the rest of the book. And it's the Book of Revelation. And while, like I said, I don't buy into it, it's a very masculine vision, it's almost as if the goddess had to pop into it. Because there, at this changing of the age story, although, you know, the Christians think it's the end times, meaning the end, because of that, they're very patriarchal in thinking that they don't know about cycles, I found this beautiful image, and it was an portent appeared in the heavens, a woman clothed with the sun, standing on the moon, crowned with stars, in labor, giving birth to the Savior. And when I connected that to my dream, I thought, wow, okay, here's an image of Lady Wisdom as a woman, not as a goddess, but conscious women who can really incorporate wisdom if they understand that symbol and that story. And so that's how it would started me on the path to writing the book.
Well, you know, and as you're saying that, you're talking about, you know, revelations and Christians, you know, I can't help my mind is going back to you know, the Dominionist Christians and, you know, Ted Cruz and all of these people, you know, they're just itching for the end times. And, you know, in a way, you know, gee, what if the joke's on them, you know, since, like you said,
right,
they don't understand cycles. And, yeah, let the end times be the end of them.
Yes.
You know,
it is.
Yeah, and we usher in the usher them out, and the cycle turns, and the goddess returns, and you think so many of them, you know, they're evangelical, and they're having this war with the Queen of Heaven, and they're going to lose the war, and she's going to be at the center of society, and gee, wouldn't that be something?
Well, you know, the goddess always has to come to bring, it's always women and the priestesses and the goddesses, right, Karen? You know, that help people die and then help people be born. And they're always there. As the feminine, the divine feminine is the transformer. And they live in a flat earth kind of perspective. Patriarchy has become so flat earth. It's what's concrete. They don't understand metaphor or symbolic language. And that's part of what I think the goddess brings back to us, too, that the imagination, it's about enriching the imagination. Like when you were telling your story from your book, what happened is you changed your imagination. It doesn't matter how many times we say something in our minds, if underneath it our imagination is still in an old belief system of, oh, my God, I'm going to be in pain. You know, but all of a sudden, you imagined Isis, and then you felt her, and you walked into her, and it changed.
Yep. She changes everything she touches.
And that's the magic that feminine brings. Yeah.
Right. And you're talking about metaphor and you know, language and symbols, and you know, that's such a rich landscape there, such a rich tapestry. But it's true, wouldn't you say, that all, like especially in dreams, you know, all symbols don't mean the same thing to all people. Aren't the symbols very personal? So there's personal symbols versus maybe archetypal or universal symbols?
Well, I think definitely there are, but I think instead of saying either or, which is very, to me, left brain, we say they're both personal and collective.
Okay.
Right? And so when you hear about a snake, you can be afraid of snakes, and you might have found one walking in the desert, and you went, ah, you know, but also snake is so ancient, and it's so powerful that it is about that, too. And so part of the trouble that I have found through these 30 years of working with dreams is that although people in general are beginning to pick up, oh, I have to look up what this means, and I have to understand what this means in the dream, or when we go on inner journeys and we have visions, we also need to be able to tie them together to understand why that particular symbol is in the midst of this story. And so understanding symbolic language is so important, I think, for women, because as we use the imagination, we have to, there's rules. There's cosmic laws, too. And we can get, we can think, oh, I can just be in the imagination, but you also have to be able to name things and understand things, you know, balance the brain in that way.
You know, last night I had the most vivid dream that I had in ages. I mean, lately I think I've just been so tired. I haven't been able to remember my dreams, and I've been every night before I go to bed, I make an effort to say, you know, please let me remember my dream. You know, appeal to the muse of memory and Black Aphrodite and night, and say, please let me remember my dream if there's something important you want me to pay attention to. And you know, one of the weirdest things that happened in my dream last night was suddenly I came upon in my house there was this colorful cluster, and as I looked at it together, you know, this cluster on the, you know, on the floor in the room, I couldn't really make it out until suddenly it started to move. And then when it started to move, I realized it was a cluster of alligators that were all like intertwined. They had been sleeping together, and then suddenly they all just woke up and sort of scattered in different directions. And surprisingly, I wasn't afraid of them. You know, you would think I would be afraid that they were going to come attack me and bite my leg off or something, but I just kind of stood there in awe of it all. I wonder if that means anything to you, because I got to tell I was perplexed.
Well, the thing, it's really interesting because I just, in my dream group last night, one of the people brought in a dream about a crocodile being around too and not being afraid. Well, first of all, you got to remember that in your dreams, you are the ego, and so it's your consciousness. And at least in a Jungian sense, everything else is part of you, but it's not necessarily the ego consciousness. It's the real story. You know, you were talking about your next guest. It's so true. We have to change our story. It's not just our thoughts. We have to change the whole story. So here's the story happening in your house, which usually represents your psyche, where you live and where you're home. And it's very colorful, so it's juicy. There's something going on. It has lots of energy. And it's an alligator or a crocodile. And one of the things I found out last night from my, you know, dreamer was that crocodiles, I'm not quite sure if alligators are the same, but they are reptilian who nurture their own children, unlike a lot of other reptiles. And
okay.
So on one level, like Seth in, Osiris's brother, Seth, he was a crocodile god. And so, of course, that's partly the devourer. But also, to me, it's beginning to feel as if it more represents the whole idea of devouring what's dead and nurturing what's coming into being. And so you do that, I think, every day in your life. So you can sit there and watch that objectively happening. So I would say to you, you feel as if you're going through a big transformation right now, again, and that things are leaving your life that you don't need anymore, and so you're nurturing that potential of, yes, take the dead stuff out. You can go. And also, you know, but there's new life. And on a very instinctual level, since it's from the reptilian brain.
Well, you know, I that has some resonance. And it's interesting, too, because I was just talking to some of the women that I'm going to probably do a Samhain ritual with. And one of the things we're going to do is, since this year has been so tough on most of us, we're going to sort of bury the old year, you know.
Yes.
Just, you know, bury the old year and, you know, and start fresh. And you know, and that sort of parallels what you just said.
Yeah, definitely.
It's interesting.
It's dreams, just like I said, you know, astrology I love, and it tells you the broad general, you know, outlines the blueprint of what your soul has chosen to deal with, how your soul wants to deal with energy, let's say this lifetime. But the dreams fill in all those places, and it's solemn, so it's time to let things go. But you're not seeing that kind of death in a scary way. You're seeing it as so much potential, so much energy there, coiled all up. So, you know, when you work with dreams, you have to know how to ask the right questions and then tie it all together, like fairy tales.
I would imagine it really can be difficult.
It's difficult, and that's why even Carl Jung said, you know, it's hard to do your own dreams. But if you know how to ask the questions and really work it, I feel like my life changed a lot because of working with my dreams. But I'm watching this group of dreamers I've had now for 4 years, and the transformations that are going on in their life are just amazing. And they're very settled and very grounded because of it.
So is there a way to help remember your dreams besides, you know, as I was saying, you know, I try to make a conscious point before I go to sleep to actually, you know, ask to remember the dream? Are there any other tips?
Yes. Well, first of all, I wanted to tell you, Karen, that the older we get and the more conscious we get, I think the less we have to remember our dreams. Carl Jung said that. It made me feel good because I have like 85 dream notebooks, but in the last few years, I only dream important dreams. I only remember, even if they're little tiny ones, okay, like just an image and a couple of words, but important for me to know. And so it's almost like as you clean out your personal unconscious, you don't need to deal with that. Most of the times with dream work in the beginning, you're dealing with your personal complexes, your fears, your worries, your values, your issues. But a lot of times as you work those through and you become your own person more and you're more self-aware and you do a lot of conscious journeying and meditation, then you don't have to remember your dreams so well.
Okay.
And then,
well, that makes me feel good too.
yeah. I wanted you to feel good. I don't want you to feel bad about it. Sometimes when I've had clients, they go, oh, my God, I didn't dream, and they get so worried. It's like, no, don't worry. It's okay. Because a lot of times the dream world wants that to be integrated into your conscious life, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you
yeah.
have to have time. It's not like, you know, every day you can have dreams, and it's very – and often they're on the same theme. So anyway, that's one of the things you can – go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, because obviously we don't transform overnight. It's a process. So, you know, I would imagine, you know, you can't very well have, you know, unless you're filled with fear or some emotion, you know, you would have transformative dreams every night because you're just not shifting that quickly.
Right. And like my dream, one of my big dreams about giving birth to the Savior, I worked on that for years and years. Like Lady Julian of Norwich, she was an English mystic. She had this vision on when, because she thought she was dying. It was kind of her deathbed, and then she got better. And she worked on it for 20, 30, 40 years because sometimes these big visions are prophetic, if you will.
Right.
You know, because when we dream, we're not in time. So sometimes we go to the past. Sometimes it's about the present. Sometimes it's about the future. So So, yeah. The other thing you can do is they always say drink water, so you have to get up and go to the bathroom. And vitamin B6 is very good to help with dreams.
Okay. Well, did you ever figure out...
And there's herbs. And I'm not talking about the illegal kind. There's certain herbs that are good for dreaming, which I can't remember at the moment. I have my friends that know that stuff, and I just sort of call them up and say, what are those herbs again?
Okay.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll have to email it to me when you remember.
Okay, so Catherine Breen did a dream tea for us once at a second ritual, and I think she used blue lotus and artemisia and different things. But I'll try to find the recipe and send it to you.
Okay, and I think artemisia, that's a form of marijuana, isn't it?
It's not, and it is. I think it's just, it's really about getting the receptive, sort of happy, I think it helps your right brain, let's put it that way, because when we sleep, our left brain, I think, shuts off, and our right brain, which continually is creating stories, we get to actually see what those stories are. And as we get conscious, we stop, and we see the story consciously if we go into the imagination like you did when you were afraid of your pain.
Right. Well, did you ever find out about you birthing the Messiah? Did you ever figure out what that was about?
I think it's about all of us women, okay, giving birth to this wisdom. To me, it was more about me doing the hard work of following the trail. And so for me, maybe personally, I gave birth to an inner savior for me. But I really believe this is a collective issue, and I think that it's all of the women in the world, but especially in America, because to me, we are the most patriarchal, industrialized country in the world. We were founded right as the Industrial Revolution took off. We were founded by Protestants mostly, who didn't have any divine feminine, whereas in South America, they had the Catholic Church had Mary at least. And so most of us in this country are what I would call father's daughters. We are daughters of the patriarchy. Like Athena, who in the Orestes said, I am for the masculine and all things.
Right,
So that's how we were brought up, right? We were brought up to be for the masculine and all things. And so my book is really, one whole chapter takes us through a fairy tale that explains how the father wants to marry the daughter. And when that happens, what do we have to do to not marry the guy? And so I tried to do it in a very Jungian way so that everyone could understand, oh, this is how you understand symbolic language, and this is the thread through it. And so not at all like Clarissa Estes in her wonderful book, Women Who Run with Wolves. I think she's a supreme storyteller. But in the same vein, if you will.
Right. Well, you know, you're making me think about those Christian groups. I think they're evangelicals. Feel free to correct me if I'm wrong. You were talking about fathers and daughters. Don't they have some sort of ball where the dads take the daughter? I mean, it just has this, you know, to me it has this sort of icky feeling of a little bit too much intimacy between the dad and the daughter. I mean, I might be wrong about that, but, you know,
I think what you're feeling is true. Like, let's talk about fairy tales for a minute. There's so many fairy tales where the daughter is really connected to the father in a very incestual way, but, you know, the fairy tales, the Jungians believe that fairy tales are the most simple structure of archetypal processes. So, you know, when we walk around and go, oh, I'm going to pick my archetype. Archetypes are bigger than that. They pick us. They're cosmic law. They're instincts for being human. And we can only know them through images and through the stories that those images give rise to. So fairy tales sort of say, well, look, this is the progress of what's going on. So in so many fairy tales, the princess rejects the suitors and they have to do tests because secretly she's kind of married to daddy, which we have in our own psychological complexes, too. But in this one fairy tale that I chose, the father first of all, the king was married to a queen who was dying and made him a promise to only marry somebody as beautiful as her and with the same golden hair. And that's the feminine of the patriarchy. It's the feminine that's heavenly, golden hair. This is heavenly, rational, feminine stuff going on. And because of that promise, because that feminine part of ourselves is so twisted and connected to the patriarchy and to the masculine, it's only when the daughter grows up that the father falls in love with her and says, I'm marrying you. That's why it's such a fantastic fairy tale, because finally it's out in the open. The father wants to own the daughter. He wants to own the new feelings that come up. It's sort of like George Bush saying, we're going to call it the Clearing Forest Initiative. We're going to give all the trees to the lumber companies, and they're going to clean out the forest for us. But they name it in such a way that you would think, oh, he's being an environmentalist. Because
right.
The new feeling is we need to take care of our earth. And so corporations and politicians, they use words that trick us and make us think, oh, they're one of us, but they're not. They're just using the feeling to sucker us in.
Right. Yeah, it's like the oil company commercials, you know, are always so green and peaceful and serene. You know, it makes you think that they really care about the environment while they're the biggest rapists, you know.
Right. So that's why psychologically it's so important to understand we are father's daughters and we need to leave the house. And so as we leave the father's house, this fairy tale describes the process. And it goes very well with the image of the woman clothed with the sun, because in the fairy tale, the princess, being a father's daughter and kind of star, says, I can't marry you, Dad, but okay, first make me a dress that's like the sun and a dress like the moon and a dress like the stars, but also I want a mantle of fur with a bit of every animal in your kingdom. Because she thinks he can't do it. But he has enough worker bees in his kingdom to get it done. And so she has to run away. And it's so interesting because what does she run away in? A mantle of furs. When you are a father's daughter, like all of us are, we're brilliant, we're smart, we followed the rules of the patriarchy. And this is what so many women have already done already. It's really talking about the archetypal path that so many of us women have already walked. And we need to go and hide in our mantle, not hide, but live in our mantle of furs, live in our instincts. And then in the fairy tale, like, oh, Cinderella, stories, which isn't about, oh, I need to get a prince. It's I need to find my own way to do things.
Right.
I need to find my own inner masculine that isn't the daddy masculine, that isn't the patriarchal masculine. And so in this fairy tale, she works for a king who's the king of the forest. So he is her own inner masculine, and then she appears in the dresses demonstrating that she understands all of those three types of consciousness, you know, left brain, solar consciousness, right brain, imaginal, lunar consciousness, and spiritual, star consciousness. And that's, to me, what all of us women are trying so hard to do. And I think that when we do it, we will have such access to wisdom that it's going to surprise everybody and the world. We just have to begin to give it to the world.
So is that the key, Kathy? I mean, because here we are, you know, you've already said, you know, we're sort of our father's daughters, you know, we're sort of under the wing of patriarchy. And, you know, when the Dalai Lama said it would be Western women who would save the world. But,
yes.
You know, you look at the Sarah Palins, the Michelle Bachmans, the Laura Ingalls, you know, all of those types who keep propping up the patriarchy. You know, do you think there's hope for those women, or do we just, I mean, will they actually transform one day, or they'll just die out and, you know, it'll be the next generation that will, you know, the millennials maybe that are going to carry the torch and really change things?
Yes, I don't think everybody's come in to become as conscious as they can be. I think we have so many degrees of different types of souls. I believe that we are souls and that we have been here many lifetimes, as so many of us do, and that you know, some souls are still stuck in being a father's daughter, but maybe their children or their, you know, maybe Sarah Palin's daughter or her children will do this because it's where things are going. I hope we don't have to have massive die-offs and have horrendous things happen for us to get to this next phase, but part of our issue is you have to go through being a father's daughter to get to the point of being a conscious woman, okay? Because we there's women who are very much in their bodies, but they're unconscious about it and therefore ruled by patriarchy, since all the cultures in the world pretty much are patriarchal right now and have been for many thousands of years. And so in becoming conscious of who we are, then we have that free will choice, which is what spirit has given us, right? Free will. But when you only know one story, it's very hard to have free will. But when we get to this other story, then we can make those choices. How do we want the story to change? How do we want the story to end? And so I don't think Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann, you know, they're going to stay father's daughters. But there's a whole lot of other women like you and me and a whole bunch of other women in the world who are searching for our freedom. And in searching for your freedom, we're going to leave the father's house. We're going to, you know, listen to our bodies. That's what living in the mantle of fur is. You know, listen to what our bodies say. Stand on the moon, which means be in the moment and listen to what the voice of the imagination is telling you about the moment. And then also choose what our values are and how we choose to live, and that, I think, is the crown of stars. And then we give birth to the Savior, which might be we need to change this law, or we need to create this co-op, or we need to help women who have been in human trafficking in this way. And so we're building a new energy body and a new story all at once as we leave the Father's house. But it's hard
work. When you figure all the different areas that patriarchy has permeated and distorted and made diseased, you know, that it's going to take a lot of us birthing new messiahs, you know, or in other words, new creativity, new ideas, new stories, new ways of doing things, you know, across the board to sort of usher that old out. Or stamp that old out so the new can be born.
Right. The most important thing is to find out. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to move on to the next question, but if you were had a follow up to that, go ahead.
I was just going to say the most important thing that we women need to do is to understand. To name ourselves, to name what we're sensing in the moment. You see, once again, we've all been through this, but this is sort of the archetypal pattern and path so that other people, other women can walk it, and hopefully other men at some point when men actually take the time to work with their feminine side. Like we've had to work with our masculine side. So women are more balanced, if we will. But you see, our head still leads our heart. We can't do that. The right brain has to be the basis of the choices we make, and then the left brain is getting us to where we need to go, I think.
The masculine,
to me, often is the doing part. They got those, you know, appendages that sort of stick out and point. So it's the doing part, whereas we, the feminine, is more the being part. And we have to learn to trust our being and our instincts and our intuitions and our feelings and then name them. Clothed with the sun, we can name them. Once you name something, you have power over it. You own it a bit. And then, you know, go out with our purpose, with our divine purpose. And like I said, it's finding our own way of doing things, our own masculine way of doing things, which has been picked on for so many centuries and ignored. You know, I guess I just, and I, the reason I say wisdom is our special gift is in all cultures, there's a few that don't, like Thoth in Egypt. But in most cultures, wisdom is feminine. It's a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I use the image of Lady Wisdom because that's the alchemical. That's what the alchemists would call Sophia, Lady Wisdom.
Right.
And we are
right.
doing an alchemical process here.
Well, and you associate Lady Wisdom with the goddess Aphrodite. Is that because wisdom and love are such good partners?
Yes, and because she is she's the goddess of the body. She says your body is divine. If you look, you know this, and I will say, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners do, but when you look at ancient gods and goddesses, we see their attributes, right? Athena has her shield, and she has the gray eyes that are piercing, and all the different Eastern goddesses, they carry their attributes. Aphrodite's attribute is her body. She's always just unrobing, and so to me, she is the wisdom in the body. And that means our sexuality, our sensuality. She's Aphrodite Urania, so she's the queen of heaven. So she comprises all the different aspects, the earthly ones. Okay, she's also golden Aphrodite. They always talk about her as golden Aphrodite and her time, you know, so she's connected to the sun. She's connected to the moon through the waters and the tide. She's connected to the stars through her role as queen of heaven. And so also she's the most raped and pillaged goddess that has come up to us from ancient times. Because of pornography and because of the way men abuse sex and the way that men view women. So in a way, she's, you know, she might not be the whole thing, but she's the beginning. Very much so. And, of course, in the myth, Aphrodite is the initiator of Psyche, which is our soul. And she initiates us into finding out what we love. So it's all connected in very many ways.
Yeah, you can see it's kind of a web, isn't it?
Yes.
So what would you say the world would look like if women and feminine right brain consciousness were equal to men and masculine left brain consciousness?
Well, I think we would make decisions based on our intuition and our feelings, okay, as well as facts. Because the other thing is, you know, what's happening right now, when I lived in Rhode Island in a little tiny town, I lived in the town the Witches of Eastwick was written about. It was a 300-year-old little village. It was so cute. And we had to fight these big corporations coming in and trying to do awful things. And you know, the facts can be twisted, but if it's grounded in what's intuitively right, what does it feel like? Like, right now, there's so much energy around these big corporations buying up water rights in cities, okay? And they can logically prove to men and to fathers' daughters why that would be a good idea. But intuitively, you really know you don't want to give your water away to any corporation. You want to own it yourself. And so, to me, a future world would be where you and I could go into a town council meeting, let's say, on a very concrete level and go, it doesn't feel right to me, and this is why. This is my intuitive hit, and this is where my right brain is seeing this. My left brain is saying, this is what's going to happen. And people actually saying, you know, you're right. Okay, what should we do? So to me, it's much more about taking kindness and love and community, welfare, as the basis, and then using our magnificent intellect to foster those things rather than to kill them.
Right. Because I'm sure, you know, when we look around the world, you know, whether we're talking about poverty or, you know, income inequality or, you know, human trafficking, pornography, domestic violence, we know something is seriously wrong. You know, we know something is seriously wrong, and we can very easily, you know, we say, you know, we know intuitively and logically that, you know, this is because, you know, we have lost the sacred feminine. But to, you know, go into people who know nothing about that and try to convince them of that, you know, without them knowing it in their gut, so to speak, I don't know, is that sort of the same thing, or are we talking about the same?
Part of the whole thing is that we have to learn to name and articulate the feelings that are mostly unconscious, and feelings come to us, and then our, the first language that feelings speak in is images. First is feelings, but then it's the imaginal language. We need to know how to translate that into the logic, and then we begin to have that wisdom, and then we can go and talk to people who don't get it, and we can tell them a story which will wake up their right brain about
right.
it. And then we can name certain things. And so we don't have to be adversarial, but we have to offer. To me, it's that whole idea of you can't leave, you know, nature abhors a vacuum. We can't just say that's bad without offering an alternative vision.
Right.
And
right,
so,
right.
And then, of course, with Aphrodite, it's all about enticement and magic and seduction. So we have to entice people to this new vision of what life could be like, because most people, you can say this is bad, but if they don't have the alternative to turn to, then they just go into freak out mode.
Right. Yeah, because,
right?
You know, because they don't, most people aren't, you know, there's a shallow end of the pool. You know, they don't know what to replace the void, you know, to fill the void with.
That's right. And you see, like right now, astrologically, we're back in the 60s. You know, the astrological signature of the 60s was Pluto and Uranus in Virgo saying we need revolution. And we had all that social and sexual and political and revolution. And we started Earth Day and, you know, all of those issues are back right now, because right now those two planets are in a 90-degree angle. It's the first square, the hero's journey. So people can, like, freak out and go, oh, my God, the world's falling apart. Or we can say, there's an alternative story. The cosmic story is saying, no, this is the next stage of the revolution. That's why everything from the 60s seems to be up again. And
right.
then you begin to have this other story that you can put all your worries and fears and energies and say, I get this, and yes, it's a struggle. So that's what why stories and archetypal patterns are so important to understand, because they channel the energy. That's what any culture, any tribal culture and patriarchy does. It channels our energy. But what patriarchy wants us to channel it into is just dead. It doesn't want to die. It's so afraid of dying that it just won't give up because it doesn't believe in rebirth.
Well, I wonder if that has something to do with why, you know, the patriarchy is fighting tooth and nail not to transform, to shift
yes.
and morph. You know, they want to stay stuck in exactly what they know, even though it doesn't serve the most of us.
That's right. That's like Saturn devouring his own children in the Greek myth. Patriarchy believes in the beginning, the middle, and the end. If you've ever tried to write a Hollywood movie, that's what they want. They want a beginning, a middle, and an end. They don't want ritual theater where everything is sort of interesting. So patriarchy is so, you know, brought into this end time. That's why these Christian fanatics believe, oh, it's the end times, everybody's going to die, and God's going to come and take us. They don't understand that in every other culture that believes in great ages, the changing of the age means that we all go through a change. And yes, one age ends, but guess what? The other's beginning. So
right.
they're in this fear. I, having been brought up around a lot of priests and, you know, my ex-husband was an Episcopal priest I was telling you about, you know, having gone to all that seminary, it's sort of like, you guys are so afraid of death. You really don't believe what you say you're believing, because then you wouldn't be afraid of death. But there's
right.
such a fear of death, whether it's the thought of we're all going to hell, and we're all going to burn, or they just don't believe in the soul. I don't know what it is,
but
I think patriarchy is on its way out, but it's so afraid of death, it's going to try to take everybody else down with it.
Down
and that's
with
what
it.
We have to stop.
Well, Kathy, we're about out of time now. I wonder quickly, is there anything that I haven't thought to ask you think's important to this, you know, to this story, for listeners to understand?
Well, I really think that, you know, I love all the goddesses. Sekhmet called me many times in my dreams, and there are many goddesses in which we can step into. But if we could, if we, the image of the woman clothed with the sun, standing on the moon, crowned with stars, there's all the goddesses right there. She's right there in one compact image. And so if we work with that image and we learn to work, you know, understanding the progress of what that means, that it is our wisdom that is going to change the world. It's the thing men have rejected. They put up statues of wisdom, and it's always a woman. But they don't listen to women's wisdom. And it's been rejected for so many freaking years. And so it's time for us to say, no, I'm not afraid to say, this is really where I think we should go. This is really what I think we should do. So I think that's the most important. But you had mentioned, I had talked to you before, if any of your listeners would like a copy of the book, a signed copy of the book, they can get a 20% discount if they tell me that they've come to me from you. And you can find it on my website. The Wisdom of Astrology website has connections to everything else that
Kathy,
I do.
Say your websites again, and if you know, if they want to get a book, I mean, can is it also available like on Amazon or the usual places?
It's available on Amazon, definitely, and of course it's cheaper there, maybe. I'm not quite sure what the price is right now, but if you get it from me, I'll sign it. And my website is wisdom-of-astrology.com. So there are the dashes in the middle. And it connects you to my book. It connects you to my newsletters. It connects you to everything there. Sort of put something together myself there.
Okay. Well, Kathy, thank you so much for coming on and explaining all of this. And I definitely hope if listeners are interested, they get in touch with you directly. We don't need Amazon getting any richer because we know their money goes to conservative causes, and conservative causes are definitely not the sacred feminine or pro-women, that's for sure. So thank you for sharing all of this with us tonight, and you know, good luck on your work, and you know, we should chat. You know, maybe if you're interested, maybe you can come on the show sometime, and you know, you can tell us you know, what's coming up astrologically or something like that.
I would. It's very important. If I have two more minutes, I'll tell you quickly. There's another solar eclipse next week, which is so important. Right now, the planet of responsibility and limitation, Saturn, is in Scorpio, the sign of our emotional patterns with intimacy. And so this solar eclipse is a new beginning, perhaps, in terms of, isn't it time that we let go of our fear about intimacy and be our truest self? And then right after that is the fourth of seven squares between those two planets from the 60s. And, of course, seven is a mystical number of initiation. So it's almost as if from now, you know, it started in 2012, the first ones, and then last year, and then this year. And then there's three more after the one in November. And seven is an is the number of initiations. So it makes me wonder, we really, really need to step up to the plate and make those changes in our personal lives by the time the seventh one comes, because we can fail initiations. We don't have to pass them. But if we really do our work, we will pass the initiation and then begin the process of changing our world. But first we have to change ourselves.
Okay.
And get rid of all those patriarchal rules inside us that make
us do what we do. Absolutely. Resist it. Realize that, you know, realize what we're doing instead of just, you know, acting out of habit or because some institution or, you know, some dogma, you know, told us to do it.
Right. The rules and the guilt and the shoulds and the oughts, and we really... The feminine is the wild feminine, but also it doesn't mean that it has to be unconscious. It's about us making what's been unconscious conscious, and that will save the world. So it's not this weekend. It's next weekend, the weekend of the beginning of November. Very intense week. Everybody pay attention to their dreams, and find my cosmic story, and you can read all about it.
All right. Well, Kathy, thank you so much. I appreciate you taking the time to share all of that with listeners tonight.
Thank you. I'm so honored to be on your show, Karen. Thank you so much. And you do such wonderful work, and you are such a spokeswoman for the goddess and the divine feminine. Thank you for being you.
Oh, you're sweet. Thank you so much. I'm sure we'll keep in touch.
Okay. Take care.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.
Well, I see my next guest is on the switchboard, and I'm going to get to Celeste Journal in 2 seconds here. But I wanted to share just quickly an article that I was reading and enjoying on Alternet, and it was called Denmark is the Happiest Country on Earth. You'll Never Guess Why. And I'm not going to read the whole thing to you. I'm just going to give you a couple reasons why Denmark is the happiest country on Earth. But it does remind me why everybody on Fox News and on the right is always saying, don't look at those socialists. Don't look at those socialists. Those are scary people. You know what? Because if we did look at those socialists and we did try to emulate, the way they live, we would have it so much better, and the quality of our lives would be so much better. Now, some of you probably already know about all of this, but, you know, it bears repeating, because if we are going to change things, you know, we need to look to other people as examples and see what works for them, and maybe it can work for us. So anyway, last month, Denmark was crowned the happiest country in the world, and the top countries generally rank higher in all 6 of the key factors identified in the World Happiness Report. And together, these 6 factors explain 3/4 of differences in life evaluation across hundreds of countries over the years. So the 6 factors for a happy nation split evenly between concerns on a government and on a human scale. And the happiest countries have in common a large GDP per capita, gross domestic profit, healthy life expectancy at birth, and a lack of corruption in leadership. But also essential were 3 things over which individual citizens have a bit more control, which were a sense of social support, freedom to make life choices, and a culture of generosity. So anyway, some of the things that make people, the Danes, happy people. First of all, Denmark supports parents. While American women scrape by with an average maternal leave of 10.3 weeks, Danish families receive a total of 52 weeks of parental leave. Mothers are able to take 18 weeks, and fathers receive their own dedicated 2 weeks at up to 100% salary. There's more details about that, but you can go to the article yourself and read it. Also, health care is a civil right and a source of social support, not this crazy idea of health care that we even have with the Affordable Care Act. You know, we should have had a public option. We should have had Medicare for all, not just making, you know, not this Republican version of health care where the insurance companies just get richer. You know, this was a corporate version of health care. But the Danes, health care is a civil right. Also, over in Denmark, gender equality is prioritized. It isn't just parents who can expect balanced gender norms. Denmark regularly ranks among the top 10 countries in a World Economic Forum's yearly report that measures gender equality. And while no country in the world has achieved gender parity, Denmark and other Nordic countries are coming close. And this is no small part because of the strong presence of women in leadership. The other thing that makes Danes happy is biking is the norm. In Denmark's most populated and largest city, Copenhagen, bikes account for 50% of its residents' trips to school and work. Also, Danish culture puts a positive spin on its harsh environment. They turn lemons into spiced mulled wine. Isn't that funny? Let's see, how do they do that? In a space where the sun shines fewer than 7 hours during the height of the winter solstice, a level of darkness that can and does stir depression and sad feelings, the concept of a cozy scene full of love and indulgence can help to mitigate some of the season's worst psychological effects. After all, both strong social connections and many of the indulgent foods associated with hygge, that's their concept of putting a positive spin on the harsh environment, such as chocolate, coffee, and wine. They are all mood boosters. And finally, one of the last reasons the Danes are some of the happiest people in the world is they feel a responsibility to one another. It's none of this crazy Ayn Rand stuff, you know, survival of the fittest, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. According to government exploration, the Danish feel responsible for one another. This is civic duty combined with economic security and work-life balance to support it. Results in a high rate of volunteerism, too. They say Denmark is a society where citizens participate and contribute to making society work. More than 40% of all Danes do volunteer work in cultural and sports associations, NGOs, social organizations, political organizations. There's a wealth of associations. In 2006, there were 101,000 Danish organizations worth noting in a population of just 5.5 million. So anyway, there is much more to read there at that article. If you want to find it, I'm sure you can find it easily. Go to alternet.org. It might have also been posted on Huffington Post, and it's called Denmark is the Happiest Country on Earth. And let me just point out that these are goddess ideals too. Isn't that interesting? Okay, well, here we go, and Celeste is on the line with us. Welcome, Celeste. Thank you for your patience.
Oh, thank you so much, Karen. I loved what you just said about Denmark because you've just tapped into my favorite television show on the air right now, which is called Borgen, which takes place in Denmark, and it's the story of a woman who rises to power, a married woman with two children who becomes the Prime Minister of Denmark.
Wow.
She gets divorced during her administration, stays in political leadership for some time, retires, doesn't like the way the government has flipped back to being very patriarchal, tries to come back into government, they won't let her back in, and she starts her own political party.
Wow.
And it's absolutely amazing. I am so hooked on it. I think it's the finest television on the air because it truly, for me, you know, I know your listeners probably don't know much about my past, but I come from Star Trek. And the Star Trek future that Gene Roddenberry painted for us when I was a young actress, that's my belief system, that men and women would live in an equal partnership.
Right,
so
right.
Here we have some Gene Roddenberry ideals going on right here on Mother Earth in Denmark. So it's amazing you would mention that.
Well, yeah, there you go. And I mean, I don't know if I told you this, but in my new book coming out, I actually have a chapter called Resistance is Not Futile, which is sort
you
of about
tell
the very
me. I love it.
Yeah, I mean, because it's the very same thing. Because, look, I can't remember when Star Trek was on prime time. And, you know, and people, I mean, I can remember being in school and kids were writing scripts and they all wanted to be like the people in Star Trek. And what was that? We cared about one another. There was altruism. You know, what did the ship do? The ship went around, you know, and what was their prime directive? You know, they didn't, they didn't harm other people. You know,
the prime directive stated that the Starship Enterprise would never interfere with the evolutionary development of another planet. In other words, every planet was on their own evolutionary course. The episode that I guest starred on, called The Apple, which was Star Trek, the original series, second season, we violated the prime directive. And I make a very strong stand that the prime directive of our planet was violated when the matriarchy fell and the patriarchy was installed with a false on a false basis. And with that, the Prime Directive was violated, and it is now our responsibility to reinstate the Prime Directive, which is to set this planet back on its course of a peaceful, harmonic, charitable place to live. The original concept of men and women being equal, all the genders, all the races, all the colors of the flowers in the gardens, everyone having their place and their responsibility to make the whole greater. And when that timeline was interrupted, you had on your show a brilliant woman, and that was my first exposure to her. That was your guest, Julia Stonehouse, the author of Idols to Incubators, Reproduction Theory Through the Ages, and Father's Seed, Mother's Sorrow. Our Prime Directive was interrupted at 3000 BC when it flipped to the male of the species being solely responsible for bringing life into this world. Prior to that, in a balanced matriarchy society, as you know, the women were not control freaks. They ruled with a gentle hand. Everyone got along. Everything was peaceful. There was enough for everyone. It was a feeling of plenty. And my personal feeling is that when we went from being heart-centered up into the head of being, you know, in the fear paradigm, the control, the domineering, the domination of women, it began with that male seed theory. And thus we had control of women because they had nothing to do with reproduction. So in order to know who the father's seed was, she had to be completely dominated and controlled. And that has stood the test of time, actually, up until 1960, with the publication of a book called Ovum Humanum that actually showed the photographic evidence of the 23 chromosomes in the head of the male sperm and the 23 chromosomes in the nucleus of the ovum, that we actually had a 50-50 role in bringing new life onto the planet. But we're still suffering. We're in the full pangs of an epigenetic hangover because of what Julia Stonehouse refers to as this reproduction theory. So is it any wonder we have Republican maniacs trying to control our reproductive rights, et cetera?
Well, speaking of the Prime Directive, if you want to put things in Star Trek context, I mean, every time Christians, for instance, have tried to send missionaries over someplace and destroyed a culture, you know, they were in violation of the Prime Directive. You know, I'm thinking about a new documentary that's out right now, and I know it's playing in some places in Los Angeles. I'm sure it must be other places as well. It's called God Loves Uganda, and it's all about Christian missionaries and the havoc they're wreaking in Uganda over homophobia, where now in Uganda they want to kill people if they're suspected of being gay. And
I
don't know if it, yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's still part of the law, but if you didn't inform on a friend or a relative who was gay, you might potentially risk going to jail. Now, I mean, that's some crazy, crazy stuff. You know, or even George Bush, I remember his administration wouldn't give aid to countries unless these countries were practicing abstinence rather than birth control. I mean, is that just insanity or what, you know?
Go from being heart-centered to head-centered, where they have the sense that only I am is what is important instead of we are, as you so brilliantly said in your last blog, we need to go from the I am society to the we are society. Otherwise, how can we account for 125 million women and girls in Africa and the Middle East who have suffered from genital cutting, from female circumcision? That's a hangover from this patriarchy, You've got to control your women so that you know where your seed is planted and that your line will carry on. Absolute
right.
hangover from the Stone Age. So,
well, and
you know,
I think that all stems from, you know, as people, you know, as ownership comes into the picture, you know, people have to know who their heirs are to pass along their assets. So suddenly that all becomes important. But, you know, there you go again. You know, it's like early consumerism.
Right.
You know?
Well, in the early days, we had the matriarchal line of succession where property was handed down only to the female in the family. So, you know, we've also got baby girls disappearing at birth in China because they can only have one child and they want to be sure that first child is a son. You know, you still have the amniocentesis in India going on to sex determine what your child is going to be, and if it's going to be a baby girl, abort it. So we're still living with, you know, as advanced as we think we are in the West, we are living with the hangover of reproduction theory.
And you know, take that a bit farther. I mean, sort of parallel to that, you know, I just went to the Lemley and saw this this documentary by the first, as far as I know, female documentarian who made a film in Saudi Arabia. Both were firsts, the first film in Saudi Arabia and made by a woman. And it was called Wajet. And it's about this young girl who grows up in Saudi Arabia, and she wants nothing more than to have a bike. Well, girls don't ride bikes in Saudi Arabia because they might ruin their virtue. In other words, you know, their hymen might break riding the bike, okay?
Right.
And so the story is, you know, centers around that, but there's sort of another thread in the story about her mother hasn't been able to produce a male child for her husband. Now, of course, we know that it's the male that determines the sex of the baby. But,
right.
you know, he leaves her and takes a second wife and hopes that he's going to have a male child, you know? So we see that kind of stuff even in the West where, you know, men, you know, put it on the wife. You know, and they think she can determine whether or not, you know, what sex the child is. I mean, I took Kabbalah classes, and they honestly said in Kabbalah class, this is here in Los Angeles, okay, they honestly said that it's a man's obligation to please his wife during sex because the more pleased she is during their commingling, their union, the more likely she is to have a boy. I mean, isn't it crazy that these kinds of ideas?
Genetic hangover from reproduction theory, and that's why it's so fabulous for you and I to both be a part of, speaking of movies, of being a part of Emmanuel Etier's magnificent Femme, Women Healing the World, because 100 of us get to speak out about how we women can heal the world. And it's going to start with belief systems. The belief systems have to be turned on their proverbial bottom. And as you probably recall what I said, your listeners may not have all seen our film yet, but what I said is it starts in the womb. It actually starts earlier than the womb. But when we women have the absolute control over these future belief systems as we whisper to the fetal tissue growing in the womb. From the moment that sperm makes it into the ova, and actually the ova is selecting which sperm is the best. It takes a little while to select which sperm the ova is going to let in for the fertilization to take place. And from that moment that cell divides with mitosis, that fetal tissue is in pure subconsciousness. So everything the mother eats, thinks, breathes, does, everything, her every thought is being downloaded into the fetal tissue. And by the time the baby is born, 50% of its personality has already been manifested. So what's going on inside the womb is the fetal tissue is actually in a frequency called delta, which is like a hypnagogic trance. It's a wide open tape recorder. It's pure subconscious. It's downloading everything into the first person. And then at birth, the baby will gently move into theta, which is wide open imagination. That first year of going from hopefully natural childbirth to breastfeeding to the little toddler that can talk to animals and speak to butterflies, at that point they're in theta, they're in pure imagination. All the way up until age 12, women have a tremendous influence on this future generation where the healing of our planet can take place. So women have so much more power than they think they have. The belief systems that are holding us back, and we know what they are, certain aspects of religious dogma, patriarchy, etc., control, domination, industrial military complex, all the up-in-the-head, fear, mentality-type paradigm, we're holding the future of our planet back. But if we can educate women, and women can choose fathers for their children, they can reevaluate who becomes their parenting partner. We really need to stand everything on its head right now and give it a good shake, because our belief systems are no longer serving us. And as, you know, we hear about moving into the age of Aquarius, that's where we start thinking for ourselves. That's where we overturn the old paradigms. And one of the wonderful things I thought that Emmanuel did was when he asked over 100 of us for how we thought we women could heal the world, I think Emmanuel truly believed that we would all say, let's flip it to a matriarchy. But none of us said that, did we, Karen? We only said, all we want is partnership. It's yin-yang. It's equal partnership. Let us co-create. Let's not make either one the creator or the creatrix. Let's co-create. And that's the message that, you know, 100 women have voiced, and you and I and the rest of the team were taking it global. I don't know if I mentioned this to you, but I just had something wonderful happen to me personally, which I hope then to be able to take and be of value to others. To get off the me thing that we're talking about, was I was contacted by an absolutely wonderful lady named Julie Ryan Gelbart, and Julie is the head of the Global Prenatal Initiative. And she has basically appointed me as an ambassador and spokesperson to help her. This is going to be a huge, huge movement that will include the United Nations. It's going to go all around the world, where we're able to really bring to the foreground conscientious parenting, prenatal as well as after birth, and even preconception, how not only will women be healing the world, but in 9 months we can make a really great step forward in the healing of the world with this global initiative.
Well, and I'm sure part of that will involve, you know, women's choice, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Julie Ryan Gerland would probably be the first to say that. We can't force people we can't force people's right to reproduce. I mean, a woman's right to choose has got to be, it has to stand forever. And knowing that we don't even have an equal rights amendment in this country, I can't believe that women have taken such a backseat. We think that we're so liberated, but in 1982, the Equal Rights Amendment didn't pass, and it hasn't passed ever since. So do we not have an Equal Rights Amendment, whatever rights we have can disappear. And that would include our right to choose. But once we choose that we want to have a child, we have the ability to have a conscious pregnancy and to be able to empower the unborn with a beautiful, loved belief system. I mean, the simplest concept in the world is just to wake up every day and for the mother to put her hands on her tummy and say, I love you, I welcome you to this world, I'm here to be your teacher, your best friend, I love you, please forgive me for anything I've done wrong, and let me just be by your side, you know, just to be the baby whisperer to this beautiful unborn child. And
well, you know, you made me think as you were describing how important those 9 months are, and then that year afterwards. Imagine, it's such a joke, you know, with the Republican family values ideas. You know, I mean, it's absurd. But imagine if these ideas, you know, you said shake everything up and let's have new values. Imagine if pregnant women somehow were able, I don't want to say be isolated, but somehow they wouldn't have to go through the rigors of working during their pregnancy, you know, the 9-to-5 grind and, you know, taking care of their family, you know, maybe they had a support system where they could, where it would be more of a leisurely time, you know, where they could actually think about the developing baby within them on a level that mothers just can't today because it's such a struggle, you know, to keep food on the table and keep the mortgage paid. But imagine if they could somehow, you know, be put in this environment of just love and support and beauty. I mean, what if we, you know, if that was like a long-term experiment, it would really be interesting to see how, you know, what children would be the result of that and how that in turn could reshape our society. I mean, is that crazy?
No, it's absolutely brilliant. I mean, can you imagine if we stopped stockpiling weapons for 1 year and we used those funds for good to help women, children, families, the next generation become conscious and not trapped in a fear paradigm of, you know, exactly where the military-industrial complex is trying to keep us? If we actually use those funds for good, which is very much what I believe it's Jody Williams says in Femme, you know, we have so many wonderful quotes that can be lifted right out of Femme, and entire documentaries can be made. Incidentally, Karen, I am writing the Femme book with my writing partner, Dr. Jean Hovey. She and I have written The Complete Guide to Holistic Cat Care and our new book, Paleo Dog. Dr. Jean is a vet, and so that's will cover an amazing holistic paradigm for dogs and cats. But she and I are writing presently the companion book to Femme with brilliant ideas, and we'll quote you for that one, you know. That can be the Karen Tate agenda, the dedication.
Well, I should tell you, I also have another one that I've said on the show before whenever we talk about sexuality, is it feels like to me it should be the mother's responsibility to see to it that her daughters and sons know about sexuality, and not just how to reproduce and how to not get pregnant, but actually know how to pleasure themselves, you know, that it's not this shameful taboo, you know, that men learn how to pleasure women and women learn how to pleasure men and vice versa, and, you know, that stops becoming a taboo subject, and it's just part of humanity, you know, it's part of our sacred sexuality. So,
well, we have to stop afraid to say words like vagina and penis and breastfeeding. You know, I have this concept that if we were to put the vagina into the Star Trek world, we could call the vagina an absolute Stargate. It's a Stargate. It's a Stargate that is entered, and it's a Stargate. It's a portal.
Absolutely.
But because of religious dogma and because of the trouncing of the matriarchy where, you know, sexual pleasure abounded. You know, we women, out of 1 month, we have 13 periods a year. We bleed for 28 days, and I love someone, I can't remember who it was that said, but how can you not worship something that bleeds every 28 days and doesn't die? You know, the woman is that miraculous. But out of that 28-day lunar cycle, we only have between 2 to 5 days of fertility. The rest of time is meant for pleasure, for mutual pleasure. And again, part of standing everything on its head is, you know, basically to re-look at everything. Absolutely turn it upside down. God was a woman. Adam was an Eve. women invented writing. You know, actually, you may think I'm kidding, but I'm not.
Well, you know, we should probably stop for a minute and tell listeners who those, you know, we keep talking about FEM, but if listeners haven't been able to attend a screening in their own city, you can catch it online. And there are lots of different ways to do it. You can go to my website at KarenTate.com, and on the front page you can link through there. You can find, I'm sure, Celeste, you probably have it on your website as well.
I do, Karen, but let's support your website. And I'm going to grab another phone because my battery is dying. So just keep telling the listeners how to do that.
Yeah, so you can go to my website at KarenTate.com, and on the first page, you just scroll down a little bit, and you'll see the logo there for FEM, Women Healing the World. And failing that, you can go on Facebook. There's a Facebook page also, you know, for FEM Healing the World.
Karen.
You know, so are you back with me, Celeste?
Yes, darling, and I've got it on my Facebook page, too, which is Celestial Musings.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, it is out there, and I believe when you click on there, it only costs $4.99. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
So, I mean, seriously, think about it. Plan to show it in your living rooms. Invite your friends over, your women friends, your men friends. Have some good stuff to eat and drink. Watch the film and talk about it. And you know what? And then tell your friends to have it in their living room and have another group of people watch
and
it
and
see it.
And young boys and girls.
Yeah, absolutely. Boys and girls, too. I mean, this I can't say enough about this film. Emmanuel worked on it for years. It's beautiful. It's upbeat. And he did such a wonderful job with this. He's a perfect example of the man of the future. You know, he's not this patriarchal, controlling man. He loves women, and it is so obvious in this film, you know, that he has created, and it should really be required viewing in schools, in churches, in corporate environments, everywhere, literally everywhere. I can't say enough good about this film.
Oh, absolutely, and we can also tell your listeners that you and I are both interviewed, and my wonderful sacred masculine, sacred twin husband, Nazim Artist, his beautiful paintings are featured, his beautiful sacred paintings are featured in the film as well. So there's some brilliant minds, Jean Houston, you and I, Barbara Margaret, Jean Shinoda Bolan, Carol
Marianne
Wells,
Williamson. Yeah,
Dexter,
Miriam Robin Dexter.
Marianne Williamson.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Celeste, hang on a second. I think someone is on the switchboard here. I want to see if they have a question for us or if they're just listening. So hang on for just a minute.
Sure.
Hi, from the 323 area code. Did you have a question or were you just listening? Oh, they hung up. I scared them away. I'm so sorry. Please come back. Please come back. But anyway, Celeste, you wanted to talk about stepping into goddesshood. What did you want to share with listeners about that?
Well, I love to talk about that, of stepping into the heart space is really how we step into our pure goddess state, where it is no longer about the I, it's about the we, the goddesses. It's about behaving as if the goddess in all life mattered. You know how the Indians will say, the God in me greets the God in you. Well, the goddess in we women greets the goddess in our sisters. And in order to really appreciate stepping into our goddesshood, we need to go way back in time. And by going way back in time, we connect to the fact that we are all sisters. Our mitochondrial Eve, our mother, was born in Africa between 150,000 and 250,000 years ago. And what the world didn't know up until, oh, say, the last 10 years, was that there was a mitochondrial DNA. And that's a DNA that connects all women in the world to our first mitochondrial Eve, and then to seven birth goddesses, if you will. In mythology, they were called the seven Anunnaki priestesses that went out into the world and carried their hybrid DNA with them. The seven daughters of Eve, there's really 26 of them, but seven of them went to Europe. And all of these goddesses are us. We're all connected by a root system. I don't know if you're familiar with this amazing tree that's in Utah. It's an entire forest of aspen trees that looks like hundreds and hundreds of trees, but it's actually only one because it's connected by this mammoth root system. And the entire forest burns down, and it grows back. And it burns down, it grows back. And I visualize us as that tree is called Pando. Some silly person gave it a male name, even though there are male and female aspen trees. So maybe it is a dude. But we are all connected with that mammoth root system right back to this common ancestor. And the only reason that we come in different colors is the trek, our celestial trek, our star trek. Those that went north needed less and less melatonin in their skin, or melanin in their skin, and they became lighter so that we could get more vitamin D into the skin. And those that stayed in equatorial Africa, they needed less vitamin D, so their skin was more full of melanin and a little thicker. So the fact that we look differently has nothing to do with our common ancestry. It just has to do with where we lived.
Climate. Isn't that interesting?
Climate, absolutely. It's all about vitamin D and folic acid being able to come to us in the necessary amounts that we need to survive in the climates. So if we could just realize that there's no such thing as religion, no such thing as race or color or creed or even gender. We are all one. We are all connected by this amazing mitochondrial DNA. Now, we women do pass our mitochondrial DNA to our sons, but they can't pass it. They can only pass their nuclear DNA. That's called paternal DNA. And the reason being is that when that little sperm penetrates the ovum and penetrates the nucleus, the mitochondrial DNA gets shoved down into the tail. So he can't pass his mitochondrial DNA, but he is every bit the recipient of it as we women are. So our brothers all over the world are our brothers as well. So if we dispense with gender, as Jean Houston so beautifully says in Femme, when talking about being godlike or goddess-like, we need all the gendering to engender. So
right.
To embrace what we are and who we are. So whether you're gay, lesbian, transgendered, so long as you're in your heart space, and we have to love one another in that we love one another in that heart space. But when we go up into our head, then we're talking about differences, then we're talking about sexism, color, religion, then we separate and we fall apart. We need to speak one language, the language of the heart. It's said that our early languages was actually all the same. We all spoke the same language. Now, whether that biblical quotation is correct or not, who knows? That, you know, God came along and took away a
That's
common language.
That's the Tower of Babel story.
Yeah, exactly. We need to speak is the heart language, and drop the skin, drop the wrapper, and speak heart to heart, hug heart to heart. Now, you can go to the beautiful goddess temples and wear goddess outfits, and you can have goddess shrines in your home, and you can quote goddess scripture, and that's beautiful, and I love it. But I think the true way to be a goddess is to speak from your heart. And I found something else, Karen, that I think is just magical. And that is, we spoke for a moment that as these cells divide in mitosis right after conception happens, very quickly, before there's arms or legs, before there's a circulatory system, there's the slight making of a spinal column. At one point in our development, we are all heart, male and female. We are all heart. That heart is actually beating. And guess what happens from that heart next? Not the arms or leg buds. The next thing that comes out of the heart is the tip of the tongue. So if that doesn't tell you we need to speak from our hearts, if that's the language we should be speaking, it's in our anatomy. Now, we have this science today, and in 100 years, what we call science today will be no better than bloodletting and leeches was a couple of hundred years ago. You know, whatever we think is science today will be turned on its proverbial head.
Years from now, right.
I can balance the patriarchy with the matriarchy, otherwise no one will even be here. But I think we've got to learn to speak that language. And once we do, then religion and culture, ethnicity, sexuality, everything will be one common denominator of speaking from our heart, finding where we agree and build on that rather than we disagree. And there's 99% of us and only 1% of them. So if we learn to vote with our dollars, if we learn the power that we have, we can really move mountains. What was that ancient play? Nazim was telling me about a Greek play. Oh, it starts with an L.
Where the women withheld sex from the men until they stopped war.
Yes.
Yeah, I can't think of the name of it, but yeah, but that's what the women did. They told their husbands that if, you know, they kept going to war, they would never have sex again.
Right,
and so
right.
That put an end to it.
Lysistra was the name of it.
Okay. Well, you know, that makes me think, you know, imagine if we could actually on our tax return say what we wanted our taxes to go to or not go to. And if we could say, no, we don't want it to go to the military industrial complex. No, we don't want it to go to oil companies. You know, we only want it to go to things that, you know, serve and uplift people, you know, social services and things like that. That would be a very interesting breakthrough.
It absolutely would. And the other thing we can do every day is sign these amazing petitions. You know, I write for a little publication called Care2, and there's a petition an hour that comes through. We can sign these petitions, and many of them make great headway. We can withhold our dollars from the people that are supporting GMO, who are, you know, sending dollars to the industrial military complex. So long as we educate ourselves, and we have so many opportunities through alternative media, we can start taking care of our own bodies holistically. We can learn how to care for ourselves. And, you know, that's such a big part of Nazim's and my work, which we call the Art of Wellness Collection. And, you know, we have those two amazing products that we just take with us everywhere we go, and that's Moxor at our website, moxart.com. That's a totally conscious commerce, all green, no Wall Street, no debt, beautiful company out of New Zealand that makes this amazing omega-3 supplement. So we can all start feeling better with using a powerful anti-inflammatory. It's got a business opportunity attached to it, so we can have a secondary residual stream of income, which empowers us, you know, financially to take a stand. And the other alternative device that we represent comes from Liechtenstein. Again, a family-owned business, no Wall Street. It's called Bamer, B-E-M-E-R. And did you see that movie Elysium?
Yes. Yes.
You remember that bed that they had on Elysium that everyone wanted to get to heal themselves?
Yeah, they would. Yeah, the bed would heal them of whatever disease or injury they had.
Without making any medical claims or diagnoses, visualize that Bamer is something like that. That everyone
wow.
can have that device in their home, that it's been designed so that it never goes obsolete. Its computer is such that it can be reprogrammed for any new technology that comes along. So once you own it, it's going to last you forever. And it's good for, again, without giving medical advice, there are no contraindications. There's only one individual that wouldn't be able to use it for a while, and that's a recent organ transplant recipient on immunosuppressive drugs, because the Bamer does increase your immune system. So
wow.
we have what Nazim and I are so excited about are our products, our books. Nazim's art has a holistic glaze on it that when you have it on your walls, it actually releases into the ambient environment these particles that are healing and give you a sense of well-being into the ambient environment. So not only are they beautiful and sacred, it's like beauty is as beauty does. It's just doing something wonderful right on your walls. So
you are most definitely walking your talk in every phase of your life.
I
was imagining, the people we would so gladly put out of business if we really could shake up the world and change things, and there really wouldn't be, gender or color or, differences in our ethnicities, if we really did just look at ourselves as, interconnected and all part of the one whole, and, we couldn't be manipulated anymore into, warring with people and having these stupid wedge issues. And, there would just be a lot of people who would stop benefiting from all the hate mongering that they do or the dogma that they preach. And it really would be a utopia of sorts.
And it's all within our power. We just need to envision it and walk our walk. One of the wonderful speakers in FEM also says, when you want clean water, you have to act for it. When you want something, you have to act for it. And one of my favorite things that I love to share with people is love is an action verb. We don't want to just want love. We want to be in the act of loving, in the act of doing, caring, working, painting, in the act of loving, of being involved, of being and becoming in the same breath. And we have so much power.
Well, you are most definitely inspirational. And as we're about to run out of time here, I'm afraid we're going to have to cut it short. But please tell listeners your website and how they can find out more about all the wonderful things you discussed tonight.
Oh, thank you so much, Karen. Indeed, the main website where I have everything kind of listed off to the left of where you can go to see all the things that Nazim and I are doing is at moxart.com, and that's M as in Mary, OXXART.com. And on moxart.com, you'll find the NazeemArtist.com website for Nazeem's art and holistically glazed prints. You'll find the Bamer. You'll find my Celestial Musings blog. And incidentally, the beautiful Karen Tate is my guest blogger at CelestialMusingsBlog.com right at this very moment. And my books are at my holistic pet website, which is called CelestialPets.com. But you don't have to write anything down except MoxArt.com, because that's where everything is. And we're very excited that hopefully we'll have a femme book very soon to accompany our beautiful film and
take off in
some of the areas that we've all, you know, opened for even more discussion.
Absolutely. Well, again, that's MoxArt, MoxArt.com, listeners. So please go there and look for yourself all the wonderful things Celeste and I have been talking about tonight. Well, Celeste, thank you so much for being on the show, and I'm sure you and I will keep in touch and no doubt do things in the future together here. But thank you so much for sharing all you did with listeners tonight.
Oh, thank you, Karen, for having me. I'm such a fan of yours. Also, if anybody would love to come to Sedona on November 1st through 3rd, I'll be speaking there at the Ascension Rising Conference, and that isn't on my website. That's galacticu.com, where folks can come to this beautiful conference about Ascension, all the things that we've just been talking about, G-A-L-A-C-T-I-C, the letter U.com, and we can have a big powwow in Sedona, November 1st through 3rd.
All right, Celeste. Well, thank you so much, and you have a great time in Sedona. Good night.
Thank you, my darling. I'll see you at the next FEM screening.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, speaking of the next FEM screening, if you're in Venice next month, there is going to be a screening for FEM at the Spiritual Source Center on Rose. So if you want more information about that, email me. But before I go, I wanted to share that other article that I mentioned, thanks to Pat, that it came to my attention. It was from the Smithsonian Magazine online website. And just real quickly here, the article is about new evidence that grandmothers were crucial for human evolution. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it gets to the point that grandmothers would help us live longer. And according to the hypothesis, grandmothers help collect food and feed children before they're able to feed themselves, enabling mothers to have more children. Without grandmothers present, if a mother gives birth and already has a two-year-old child, the odds of that child surviving are much lower, because unlike other primates, humans aren't able to feed and take care of themselves immediately after weaning. The mother must devote her time and attention to the new infant at the expense of the older child, but grandmothers can solve this problem by acting as complementary caregivers or supplementary caregivers. So anyway, that's a very interesting grandmother hypothesis, and they go into it a bit more and explain it in a little bit more scientific detail. It's interesting because it says grandmothering gave us the kind of upbringing that made us more dependent on each other socially and prone to engage each other's attention. This trend, the researcher says, drove the increase in brain size along with longer lifespans and menopause. The theory is by no means definitive, but the new mathematical evidence serves as another crucial piece of support for it. This could help anthropologists better understand human evolution and should give you another reason to thank your grandmother. So anyway, go to SmithsonianMag.com and look up the article, New Evidence That Grandmothers Were Crucial for Human Evolution. I think we kind of knew that anecdotally, didn't we, those of us who really had great grandmothers? So, listeners, I just want to thank you for tuning in with me again tonight, and I want to let you know I will not have a show next week because a dear childhood friend of mine is coming to visit from my home state of Louisiana, and we will be on the road together. I'm going to take her around Los Angeles to see the sights and let her see how we live here in Blue State, California. So please avail yourselves of the rich voices that are there in the archive. I'm sure there's much you have not had a chance to listen to yet. And as we come to the close of tonight's show, I want you to remember something very important, lest we never forget. It's important to repeat and punctuate again and again. We are the cognitive minority, just like the scientists who were trying to convince medieval Christians in the church that the world was not flat and the sun did not revolve around the earth. We have an important message with the sacred feminine ideals of liberation theology. And what Gandhi says fits right in. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So good night, listeners. Thank you very much for your feedback. Please check out my books. Hit the three F's on Facebook, follow and friends, and let me hear from you. Let me know what you like about the show, what topics you'd like to hear me bring to you, or even some ideas for guests. So until November, have a great Samhain, and have a wonderful week, and I'll be back with you the beginning of November. Good night.